my mom signaled for me to go, and then she goes, we're not. So there, you got the drum roll-ish thing happen in the beginning.
Yep. Daphne, we had our podiversary on November 12th this year. It was three. November 12th. And we've been entertaining people 19 seconds at a time for 3 years. Yeah. Or not entertaining them for 3 years at 19 seconds. Why? They turn it off at 19 seconds.
Yeah. Something. It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. We're having a good time ourselves. Anyway, what's your disturbing fact? Let's roll. You said no bullshit.
No bullshit.
She literally, before we cut into no bullshit, I'm like, I don't want to fucking hear about it. It just happens. So give me your bullshit disturbing case that we're going to, disturbing fact, not case, that we're going to go on about for 18 years, maybe 19. I don't know. That nobody's going to listen to. Tell me the info.
All righty then. Okay, well, you caught me off guard because it's only like a minute in and you're ready to roll.
I am ready to roll.
Okay.
Really? Because I said no bullshit and then you looked at me like death glared.
Well, because there's, yeah, okay, whatever is what it is. I'm banging everything. Sorry. I'm the elephant in tap shoes this week, I guess, or this time. All right.
Go.
This is the story of a girl who
cried a river and drowned the whole world.
Yes, but it's
well,
not.
She looks so sad and lonely there. I absolutely love her.
Yep, but
I won't sing for you.
Have you heard of powwowing and...
Like having a powwow?
No. Okay, this disturbing fact is about what is known as powwowing or some other word that I can't pronounce. Its roots are based in...
What if the other word is something I know?
You won't.
Okay.
The other word for it's also referred to as bracharella. Bracharel.
Bracharel?
Yes, bracharel.
I don't know what that means. I'm just acting like I do.
Okay, so it's bracharel. That's what is popularly known as.
No, all right.
Just kidding. Or popularly known as powwowing, hex reel. And of course, it's also known as the art of black magic.
Oh, of course.
Of course. Don't you know? So powwowing, as it's, I guess, most typically known, goes back to the 18th century. And it's the Pennsylvania Dutch. So 1700s, right? The Pennsylvania Dutch practiced powwowing all the way back into the 7th century.
Sounds like you should have read this maybe before you rocked with it.
I'm like having a day, but I want to record. So, hey, here you get me.
Great.
So it originated this...
Lowest views ever.
Except for we're not even visible, but whatever.
Lowest listens ever.
So this originated from German immigrants who brought European folk traditions with them to colonial Pennsylvania. And the practices evolved over time, drawing from sources like German grimoires and Christian texts and like people just starting to add in a whole bunch of stuff, right? So it was used for centuries, this black magic, if you will, for healing humans and livestock, and as well as just general protection.
It was good witchcraft before witchcraft was bad witchcraft.
It was witchcraft, yep. So a Pennsylvania family known as, their last name is Bretzius. The Bretzius family living in Auburn, Pennsylvania, had what they thought was their dream home.
All of our friends already know we can't talk. Like, it's fine.
Okay.
I don't think we need to do a disclaimer. By the way, today we still can't words.
By the way, we're still going to suck at pronouncing shit. Pronunciation is not our deal.
Pronunciifying is hard.
Yeah. So this family in Auburn, Pennsylvania was going, like, they love their house, but, like, there's no insulation because it's an old house. So they start opening up the walls so they can put like insulation, because it's 2012 when they did this.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. You didn't say what year it was.
Well, this family in 2012, a really long time from now.
If the earth is even still around.
God, we hate each other right now, I think.
Do we? I wasn't sure I hated you, but okay.
Okay. So they tore out their walls. Or we'll cut holes in their walls to put insulation in. And their walls were packed full of dead animal carcasses.
That's how they kept the house warm.
Yeah, for sure. Wrapped in newspapers dating back to the 1930s and 1940s, along with spices and other random objects. And so this was the powwowing thing that people were doing. And so this was happening, these newspapers are from the 1930s and 40s. Okay. So people are wrapping the carcasses of dead animals in 1940 and putting them in the walls of their house to protect themselves.
Yeah, I mean, witchcraft didn't stop just because they started hanging people.
Black magic.
The real witches just got smarter.
Yeah, but that's weird.
So, I mean, it's true. The real witches just got smarter.
Yeah, I suppose.
The poor girls, though, who were hung. I'm sorry.
That weren't witches.
Yeah, probably not.
So anyway, so that's the powwowing.
And it's just meant to keep you safe?
It's meant to protect humans, livestock, and also for like health and healing. If you have sick sheep and you don't want your whole herd of sheep to get sick, so you take one of those sheep that died. I don't know if you always shove it in the walls of your house.
Right. That was my next question, because I always threaten a taxidermy Bruno. So... that was my next question.
So anyway, the disturbing fact of it all, besides it's not really the witchcraft and it's not really
people
the practice
putting dead
of
animals in their walls purposefully.
The disturbing fact of it all is the fact that this family in 2012 opened up their walls.
2012.
This family in 2012, just 2012, opened their walls and found dead animal carcasses stuffed in the walls of their house. Can you imagine if you...
No, I would probably die. Like, I would probably keel over and die in that moment. Oh my God. I had such bad PTSD brought up yesterday when Dad said he had to go clean up a cat's carcass, not one of our cats. Anyway, my dad was like, I have to go clean up a cat carcass. And my cat, when she got outside and died a couple of years ago, and Dad found her riggered, and Dad was like, it's okay, you can touch her, it's fine. I think that's the first time I've ever touched an animal that was already dead that hasn't been euthanized. Like that I have, you know, like I didn't let Pixie go after she got euthanized, but that was in Teddy. But that was a little bit different of, you know, they were euthanized right in front of me. Like I was holding them from living to after, but Aspen was already dead. Mm-hmm. I don't know that the thought of touching dead things, though, really freaks me the fuck out. I don't know what I would ever do if I found a dead body or B, a dead animal inside of my walls.
Ugh. Yes.
Just fucking take me out right then and there.
Yeah.
Well, I will be the next body that is found.
Like, I don't know what. Yeah. And how long are you living in this house? Because I don't think it said anywhere like when they bought the house or anything.
Well, I guess at that point, the decomposition would have already happened and they wouldn't smell anymore.
No, they wouldn't smell at all. It would just be skeletal remains wrapped in newspapers with some fucking basil.
And fur.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, pelts last a long time, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know how quickly those disintegrate. I mean, if they're not in natural environmental conditions, I don't think that they do for a very long time. As I'm looking at my bear who is on the wall, but we didn't hunt this bear. This bear was abandoned and we gave it a home. And now it's in my eclectic office.
He was abandoned at the taxidermy shop. And I don't know why someone was at the taxidermy shop, but
why my dad was at the taxidermy shop.
Yeah. And he bought the bear. And so
Steve, my dad's best friend.
So I had to think about the fact that we're just rescuing the bear because he was left behind. Somebody shot him, had him mounted for whatever, and then never came back for him.
So. Yep. So I saved Amy's in my office now.
I am so ready to hear this, Daphne.
Okay. So
happy birthday, Vienna.
Yes. 7 months later. This isn't the one for Vienna.
Oh, shit. You said you're gonna have it for your birthday.
I know, but it's hard. The one she has is hard. This one, and it's not true crime. And I figured you and I had an off-mic conversation about needing to do more true crime for our visibility. Mm-hmm. And so this is a true crime case. What Vienna wants is not true crime. It's on the supernatural conspiracy theory plane. So you can interject and tell me if you know the case, but it is a more well-known case. So therefore, I hope I did it justice. I hope I do all of them justice, right? Of course. But yeah, I hope I do it justice. And I'm starting it off like Gail. In the middle of the afternoon on July 18th in 2003, four young people were shot to death in a living room of a Clear Lake home, which is in Houston area. Mm-hmm. The victims were 18-year-old Rachel, I just watched a video on how to say her last name. Colorudis, and Tiffany Rowell. And both had just graduated from high school. They were 18 the summer after graduation. Tiffany's boyfriend, 19-year-old Marcus Priscilla, and Marcus's cousin, 21-year-old Aldebert Sanchez, and he went by D.
That's so sad. They had their whole lives ahead of them. And you just graduate from high school, and you're like, yes, I'm done with high school. And you think adulting is going to be awesome.
The house actually belonged to Tiffany.
Oh, seriously?
Which is cool. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, she bought the house.
At 18?
Uh-huh. How'd I think she bought it at 17.
How'd she do that?
Probably family's help. I don't know. Unfortunately, not a lot of victim information.
Of course.
But we were going to dive into them at the end of the episode, because that's how we're going to wrap it up with a pretty bow, talking about the people who were taken too soon.
Okay.
Yeah. So just stop jumping.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah. Stop jumping the gun, Gail.
Okay.
So the killers used two guns and fired over 40 shots in an ambush. That seemed like it was personal, but investigators were also like, kind of looks like a drug deal gone wrong. But one of the lead investigators on the case, Andrew Taravella, said, quote, "We had that aspect of this is somebody that they knew or trusted," end quote. Hundreds of tips came to the Houston police, but they went nowhere and the case went cold.
Was there forced entry in the house or?
No.
Okay.
That's why it looked like
somebody they knew.
Yeah. So nearly 3 years after the murders, police received a tip through Crime Stoppers that linked them to the killers.
Okay.
In
what year was this?
2003 that the murders happened.
Okay.
And then in 2006, the first arrest was made.
Okay.
So let's talk about the killer now, giving it all up. But of course, you know, there's the most information on this person who gave herself up way too fucking quickly in the interviews that she was having with the police on the day she was arrested.
Okie dokie.
So Christine Marie Paolila, I can't say her name, doesn't matter. She's a piece of shit. Was born on March 31st, 1986 in Long Island to Lori, who was a stay-at-home mom, and Charles, her dad, who was a construction worker. She had one older brother, and when she was 2 years old, her father was killed in a construction accident.
Aw, sad day.
So, I know. Following the death of her husband, her mom began abusing drugs, eventually lost custody of the kids to her parents, so they're being brought up by the grandparents at this point.
Still,
you know,
that sucks.
Oh, it totally sucks. You know, it's just a bad domino effect.
Mm-hmm.
When Christine was in kindergarten, she was diagnosed with alopecia, which caused her to, you know, lose her hair, her eyebrows, her eyelashes. Alopecia makes your hair fall out.
Right,
if you didn't know.
Kids are mean.
And kids are mean. So as a result of this, she had to start wearing wigs because, you know, insecurities.
Mm-hmm.
She also had poor vision, so she was wearing very thick glasses, which, you know, just didn't help her self-esteem when everyone's bullying her and she doesn't like the way she looks and everyone's mean to her about the way she looks. Then she was eventually reunited with her mom, who had overcome her drug addiction, remarried, moved the family to Clear Lake City in Texas, which is a suburb of Houston. Christine was enrolled at Clear Lake High School, where she met two popular girls, Rachel and Tiffany, the two murder victims, two of the four, I should say, who helped her improve her appearance.
Okay.
And fit in kind of thing, you know, kind of Cher and Ty from Clueless.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That
okay. Cher I was thinking Sandra Ty. D, or not Sandra D, but Sandy in Grease. Although
she was
cute.
She didn't need any help with her appearance. She just went from being Sandy to being a pink lady to being kind of grungy for that era.
Yeah.
I was
looking like she was 40 at the end of the movie.
No shit. Wasn't she 40 by the end of the movie anyway?
Aw, R.I.P. Olivia Newton-John.
Oh my God, I love her. That's one of my favorite movies of all times. Ironically, though, Christine actually kind of looks like Brittany Murphy, in my opinion.
Hmm.
So just kind of ironic that, you know, literally she was, what's the movie? She's All That. The movie She's All That, where he takes her and gives her a glow up and nobody recognizes her.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, in 2003, she was voted Miss Irresistible by her high school student body.
Oh, that's
so
cute.
She really made a big turnaround on her self-esteem, her appearance.
The ugly duckling turns into the golden goose.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
So her mom, Lori, said, quote,
or no, the beautiful swan. That's the fucking analogy. I'm so tired. Excuse me.
Yeah, it's okay. I was picking up what you're putting down. Ugly to pretty. Yes.
Yes.
Simple. Somebody.
Ugly, pretty. Except for she probably wasn't ugly.
No, she's actually really cute. Yeah.
She just thought she was.
Well, I mean, God, could you imagine people picking on you and, you know, you're losing your hair. So you already have these insecurities.
When you're six.
Yeah. So anyway, her mom, Lori, said about her being voted Miss Irresistible. They did it because they felt the person she was, who they just loved because of the way she was, because of the person she was. So, you know, they thought that they really, truly loved her. And that's why they voted her Miss Irresistible. Not it wasn't like a pranking thing. It was a real.
Right. It wasn't like
it was out of thing. Real admiration and love and respect for her and who she was.
Right. Not like a Carrie thing.
Yeah. No, not like a Carrie thing. Yes, that's a great. That's a great, horrible example. So that year, she began a relationship with 21-year-old Christopher Lee Snyder. Lori and the stepdad didn't like Christopher. Neither did Rachel or Tiffany. He was a drug user, had an extensive criminal record. I don't know what the crimes he committed were. I'm assuming probably like theft and kind of petty crimes because he was never in prison.
And drug related, probably.
Yeah. But these fears would be substantiated, obviously, as Christine would start using drugs, and this was all, you know, because of Christopher. And Lori, her mom, said that he like really isolated her from her friends and family. Lori had said that Christine had indicated that she was raped by him and that the relationship was abusive, obviously clearly dysfunctional.
Right.
Christopher's family also said the relationship was extremely tumultuous and that Christine was very prone to jealousy, and that after one fight they had, Christine spent the night on his family's front lawn and threatened to kill the family. So, like, they just, you know, have a very messy, ugly, up and down, ugly relationship. I think I already said ugly, but let's emphasize that. And
like explosive, dysfunctional.
And obviously he's exposing her to drugs now. Like, she was, I don't know if she was necessarily a good girl, but she wasn't using heavy drugs. Mm-hmm. And now she's using heavy drugs. So let's fast forward to now, the day of the murders. Christine and Christopher went to Tiffany's home, right, in Clear Lake City. Also at the home was Rachel, Tiffany's boyfriend Marcus, and Marcus's cousin Dee. And according to Christine, she and Christopher planned to steal drugs that were there because allegedly Marcus was a drug dealer and was dealing out of Tiffany's house.
Solid.
So, yeah, but who knows if it's just like
you said, allegedly.
Well, who knows if it's also just like he had, you know, like a gram of weed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they were going to go get a nug.
Yeah.
And smoke a joint. Like, who knows, you know, what the extent of that is. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Christopher reportedly then got into an argument with Marcus, which led to the shooting of all four people in the home. All of the victims were shot multiple times with a 9mm semi-automatic pistol and a 38 caliber revolver. Rachel attempted to crawl to the phone to call 911 after she was shot, but Christine struck her in the head multiple times with the butt of the revolver.
Jeez. I knew it had to be a semi-automatic weapon because there's 40 rounds.
So, yeah. But she,
That's not a 38 revolver. I was like, a 38 is like six shot.
Okay.
Six, it holds like six bullets.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously you're not going to be able to shoot 40. You're like, wait, hold on. Let me reload.
Yeah. Well, one gun and then another gun.
Yeah. Well, you said 9mm semi-automatic.
Yeah. 9mm semi-automatic. And then Christine had the revolver. But we're going to dive further into it. But anyway, she bashed Rachel's skull in with the gun.
Lovely.
Both girls were shot in the groin.
Howie.
So, you know, like their female regions, kind of. Yeah.
Then that's like a hate thing.
Yeah, it totally is a hate thing. Christine and Christopher left very little evidence at the crime scene, obviously. They weren't busted right away. Mm-hmm. Which led the police to think that it was drug related again because of the allegations about Marcus potentially selling drugs from the house. Mm-hmm. But, you know, any drugs that were there were gone.
Yeah.
Because they stole them. Mm-hmm. Dee, Marcus's cousin, had literally just moved to Clear Lake to get away from the North Side violence that he was, you know, around in his life and was trying to like shape up his life. And this was literally like a week or two before he was killed in the home.
Wow.
So it's really sad. The police only had evidence of like some descriptions of some suspects that people may have seen walking around by neighbors. So there wasn't like a lot to go off of. There were some sketches drawn, but anyway, not a lot to go off of, right? Mm-hmm. An hour after the murders, Christopher then drove Christine to Walgreens because she had to work at the makeup counter. So literally, wow. You know, I'm going to go kill my friend and I'm going to go to work. What the fuck?
Yeah, that's sociopathic behavior.
Something. It's not good. It ain't right and it's not good.
I'm all technical and you're all, it's bad.
It's bad behavior. Very, very, very bad. So the case went cold. Like I said, the victim's family searched incessantly for answers over the next 3 years. Police, you know, obviously weren't really too hot on the case. They weren't finding out what needed, you know, they weren't doing their due diligence, clearly.
Right.
Because if they were, they probably would have found the friends.
Yeah.
And
they would have found the links.
Yeah, they would have found the links. So anyway, George, Rachel's dad, had printed and handed out flyers to local residences.
Sorry, I just feel like, too, when cops think that something's like drug related or whatever,
they stop.
Yeah, it becomes not. I'm not saying all the time. It becomes
political.
It becomes less important to them. Like in the 70s, how all the girls that went missing were just on drugs and runaways and not like actually killed and kidnapped and killed.
Right.
You know, it's like
the 11, the case of the 11. They thought that like, they were, some of them were just off doing whatever, not that they were murdered.
Yeah. Well, that's
what, and abducted.
Like, it's just not as important. It's not high priority. This is a drug related murder.
They put themselves to your tough shit.
Basically.
We have higher priority cases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're arresting that crackhead for having a nug of weed on him.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
He wasn't really on crack. He was just caffeinated. Anyway, so George, Rachel's dad, printed, handed out flyers, local residents, put up billboards along the Houston Highway, was raising awareness about the case, offering a $100,000 reward, you know, trying to solve his daughter's murder. So in 2004, then Christine and Christopher broke up after he was in jail for car theft in Kentucky. Sorry, he was in Kentucky.
Okay.
But she was still in Texas. She entered a rehab facility in Kerrville, Texas. There she met Stanley Justin Rott, who goes by Justin, who was also a heroin user. Awesome. And she began a relationship with him. The couple was then married in March of 2005. And around that time, Christine came into $360,000 of a trust fund left by her dad.
Wow.
Probably because that was, you know, the time she was allowed to touch it. Yeah.
Yeah. Just guessing.
Yeah.
Or 25 or something.
I think 21. I mean, they were 18 and it's 3 years later.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Duh.
Christine used some of the money to buy a house. So she actually did something correct. Then in July of 2005, the second anniversary of the murders, Christine saw a news blip on like a blip on the news about it.
Mm-hmm.
And she became like really upset, obviously visibly distressed, all the things. And she saw the sketches of herself and saw the sketches of Christopher.
Oh, shit.
And so she was like, Justin, I have something to tell you.
Full disclosure.
We did this. And then with her, he went into hiding.
Oh.
Yeah. So kind of weird. But there were sketches on the TV of them, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, that's what you said.
We'll post the sketches on the Instagram.
In 5 weeks.
Yeah, basically. We'll post the sketches on the Instagram. But they're like, okay, sketches. I'll show you after this.
Okay.
They're okay. They did an okay job. Anyway, so yeah, they went into hiding.
Okay, but Justin, I have a question. So they did sketches of them. Did they know who it was? Did they say?
No, they just the eyewitness descriptions.
Okay, got you. So they didn't have like, we're looking for these two people and this is what they look like because we don't have pictures of them. So it's an artist rendering. It was just like, hey, these are the people that I saw. But yes. Whoever saw them didn't say anything for 3 years.
No, the people who saw them, they just couldn't find them. Like they gave what they saw to the police. They drew up the sketches.
At the time?
Yes. At the time of the murder, then there were neighbors. We're going to talk about it when we get to the trial.
Sorry.
But there were neighbors who saw them. I told you that there were eyewitnesses, but they didn't know who these people were. And so they just gave them, you know, this person looked like this. This person looked like this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's even anything that's like potentially wearing a wig or anything like that, you know? Mm-hmm. So nothing that's like too identifiable when it comes to her, I suppose. I don't know. Here, let me tell you. Hang on.
No, it's fine. We can get there. I'll follow along.
I have it pulled up in one of my 86,000 tabs here, of course.
Research is fun.
Yeah. Depict a male and a female. Both were in Houston. The female and male were dressed in all black and on foot on a hot July day. The female had a scarf or a cap on her head and was carrying a large jet black bag.
Okay.
So that was the description, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Showed up there at about 3:30 and then their bodies were discovered at 6:30.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Who discovered their bodies?
Friends.
Okay.
I didn't want to get too hung up on that. So yeah, I was trying my hardest, like, not to rabbit hole, because I was like, what's out there's out there. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get too stuck on things because I was trying to produce an episode quicker rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
So not that I didn't do my due diligence on researching. I was just not trying to get caught up on every little last detail and rabbit hole. Because I feel like that's what puts me off about wanting to do cases, too, and gets me kind of in a rut when it comes to researching, is it's like sometimes I rabbit hole so hard on things and it's like, OK, I've lost my interest on something or another because now I spent too long trying to go down this rabbit hole and opened up this door and opened up that door. And it's like I left the other door of the whole entire case behind.
Yeah.
You know,
ADD.
HD.
ADHD.
Anyway, okay, so they went into hiding in November 2005. Christine and Justin were living in a motel room in San Antonio for the next 8 months. They holed up in the room. They were shooting up heroin and snorting cocaine, getting, you know, your uppers, your downers, getting in the middle. Everything's all good in the hood, I guess.
Yeah, sounds like a great time.
Yeah, no shit.
Party, party.
On July, what? On July 8th, 2006, police received an anonymous tip via Crime Stoppers. Mm-hmm. We keep talking about Crime Stoppers. Yes, they're coming back.
Love Crime Stoppers.
Regarding the murders, the details that were given by this male caller said details that, like, only the killer and the police would know. Basically, they said that Rachel was beaten to death while she was trying to crawl to call 911.
So Christopher's the one that made the anonymous call?
No.
No. Okay, well, you said it had to be somebody that knew.
Yes. Didn't she tell her husband?
Well, I didn't know if she told him all the details.
Well, she told him. Although, I saw things that said it was later reported that he wasn't the one who called, but then I don't know who would have called, so I don't know. Anyway, yeah, male voice, maybe was Justin, maybe wasn't Justin, but no, it was not Christopher. That is fact, that it was not Christopher.
Okay.
Yeah, so anyway, she admitted to male person, I was a part of this. I beat my friend to death, which is why we know that she beat her friend to death was mm-hmm. because of this call right here, because she's going to deny it for all of time, of course, that she beat her friend to death.
Okay.
Her version of events is very different than what's...
the crime scene?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yes. So police tracked Christine down in San Antonio and arrested her on July 19th, 2006 at 11:55 a.m. That's important. The timestamp is important right there.
Okay.
When police entered the hotel room, there was a bunch of evidence that they had been using substantial amounts of heroin, hundreds of used syringes everywhere. She was wearing a t-shirt stained with blood and she had needle marks like all over her body.
Jeez.
Christine's husband, Justin, was also arrested because of the 70 vials of heroin that was in the room.
Hmm. Wow.
After their arrest, Justin told the police that Christine had confessed to him that she had been an active participant in the murders. He stated that Christine had gone back into the house and beat Rachel to death with a gun after finding her still clinging to life and attempting to call 911.
Okay. So her husband said it too. So the Crime Stoppers call said it and... the husband said it.
That's why we don't know if it's him or not. Like, there's been denial over it, but also acceptance of it. But, like, I saw that it was reported that it wasn't actually him, but then there wasn't answers of who it actually was. But it was brought up in the trial. So, I don't know. Confusion may or may not have been him, but it's talked about in the trial, which we will get to.
Okay. Well, I don't know if you can make that call if you're high as fuck.
Have you heard this case before?
I have not.
You've never heard of this case?
I have, and Daphne's eyes just got big as little flying saucers.
I thought you would have heard of this case before.
No.
That's crazy. I mean, it's commonly referred to as either the Clear Lake murders or the Miss Irresistible murderer or something like that.
Nope. Haven't heard it either way.
Okay. So Christine initially obviously was like, oh my God, I didn't do it. It was all my ex, Christopher Snyder. So on July 21st, 2006, Christine and Christopher, who he was not yet apprehended, were both charged with capital murder.
Was he still in jail in Kentucky?
He was not in jail in Kentucky anymore.
Okay.
I'm going to catch up to him in two seconds.
Sorry.
You keep asking questions like right before I'm about to hit it.
You do that to me too.
Yeah, but I'm not.
Yeah, but.
No. I'm like, I don't know if I'm actually right about to hit it when you ask me questions. Like, literally, just let me read this. Christine's bail was set at $500,000 because she was considered a flight risk. And then my next line is, so let's catch back up with Christopher.
Yay, Christopher. Except for not really.
Yeah, fuck Christopher.
Fuck Christopher, but I want to know. I want to catch up.
Yeah, we're catching up with him right now. So in June 2006, he moved to Greenville, South Carolina, where he was living with a woman who he'd met online. Odd. Don't really know many details there. After Christine's arrest in July, one of Christopher's family members called him to inform him that there was a warrant for his arrest in relation to the murders. So then he killed himself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Didn't see that coming.
Somebody gave a tip to the police that he may have killed himself, and police went to Greenville and searched the area where he was reported to have last been seen, and his decomposing body was found in a very heavily wooded area on August 5th, the same year, 2006. It was later determined that he had overdosed on a prescription medication.
Wow.
Coward.
Fuck that is him. So true. Okay.
Coward.
Coward.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's like, and to take pills.
Right?
Like, that's like the way next to take level the easy of being way off. A big baby.
Right?
Like, I've killed these people and I don't want to go to jail. I can't even
shoot myself in the head.
Yeah, exactly.
Or hang myself.
Yeah.
I'm just going to take pills. I'm going to go to sleep and never wake up.
Yeah, I'm going to go peacefully.
Yeah, it's fucked up.
Yeah, peace.
I hope he didn't go peacefully.
He doesn't deserve that.
Nope. So during her interrogation, she was escorted to the San Antonio Police Department, obviously, where she agreed to be interviewed, like, on tape. They have taped interviews and recorded interviews of her. Mm-hmm. And during the investigation, she admitted to driving to Tiffany's home. They were there to purchase drugs and that they went back a second time because they forgot something. That's okay. What she told the police. The interview ended, but the tape was still rolling. Mm-hmm. And she was... like, they have, like, this footage of her, like, very visibly becoming, like, sick and starting to, like, deteriorate. She was beginning to get, like, really weak and sick. And then she requested to see a nurse because she was bleeding. And then she was transported to Santa Rosa Hospital at about 4:12, where her medical records show that she was on her period, but there were no other signs of bleeding.
Well, she's got to be in withdrawal, right?
Yep, that's exactly it. She said that she hadn't taken heroin since roughly 10 a.m., and she was accustomed to taking it, guess how often?
Every 2 hours?
Every 10 to 15 minutes.
Holy shit.
Yeah. I know. I'm sorry. You can't see our faces, but I just gave my mom like a, that's so generous.
Wow.
Guessing that she could go 2 hours without it. No. Bitch went every 10 to 15 minutes.
Jeez.
Yeah. But this day, you know, she was arrested at 11:55, hadn't taken it since approximately 10 a.m.
Well, yeah, that's your 2 hour window. That's why I said 2 hours.
Nope. 10 to 15 minutes. I'm like, geez. So at 5:30, wow. She was given 6 milligrams of morphine and 20 milligrams of methadone. And then using only an audio recorder, interrogators continued their interview while she was in the hospital at about 6:15. During this session, she, you know, denied ever entering the home. She could hear that there was a fight. Christopher admitted to shooting all of the victims. Then the interview ended like an hour later at about 9 p.m. Just before they discharged her, she was given more morphine and more methadone. And then she was flown to Houston, where she had a final tape recorded interview that she stated Christopher forced her into the house on a second trip where she was forced to hold his pistol, and that she was that he pulled the trigger while she held the gun.
OK,
so just like the math is not mathing.
No.
So I don't really care about her needs, like, at all. But a lot of the trial was spent arguing. So her only expert witness that was called in was a doctor who reviewed the tapes, right? That's why I made it a point to say that there were tapes. Mm-hmm. Where it was like the doctor was, I think, Dr. Glass. I didn't put it in my notes, but I'm just bringing it up. Why didn't I put it in my notes? I don't know. I'm like, I'm not going to talk about it. Talking about it.
relatable.
Anyway, her only expert witness was like, she was going down because of heroin use, right? Like, she was very visibly all of a sudden starting to deteriorate because of her addiction. Mm-hmm. And she would have said anything to get help is what this testimony was that, you know, she would do anything to get help. She's a heroin addict. Like, she's looking for help. She would do anything. You can see that she's clearly distressed. Who knows if she was telling the truth because she's just she's avidly looking for some more heroin. She's looking for help. She's looking to ease her pain that she's now feeling. She'll say anything she wants.
But she's denying it at this point. So she's not like, give me some drugs and I'll admit everything.
She's right. still denying it. So that's bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't really care about that part, but we'll continue to jump into the trial. Worth a mention that, you know, that was literally what she tried to, that was her only expert witness.
That's her defense.
Yeah.
I'm a drug addict and I'll say anything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So two eyewitnesses placed Christine at the scene of the crime, Michelle and Craig Lackner, who were the next door neighbors to Tiffany.
Mm-hmm.
The Lackners testified that on the day of the crime, they both observed a young man and a young woman casually walk down the street, approach Tiffany's house. They identified Christine as the girl they had witnessed. They denied seeing her with a gun, but they said that she was carrying that purse and using a six-person photo spread, they were able to pick her out of a lineup and mm-hmm. able to pick Christopher out of a lineup.
Okay.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Christopher's dead by this point.
Yeah. Yeah. He was dead. Because you
said he was found August 5th and he was already decomposing.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking when you were saying that she was saying.
I think the trial must have started taking place. Let me look.
Well, I was thinking.
In 2008 sometimes. So she was sitting in jail for a long while.
Good. But I was thinking when you were saying she was in the hospital and she was blaming everything on Christopher, I was thinking, well, he's dead, so he can't defend himself. And then I was like, well, wait, at that point, he's not dead because he didn't, like, she got arrested and then his family was like, oh, dude, you have a warrant out for your arrest. And then he went and killed himself.
So no, he was never questioned by the police, nothing. But I would say that that's pretty admittant of guilt.
Yeah. I would say so.
Killing yourself instead of, you know, turning yourself in. You have a
warrant out for your arrest for murder. Oh, fuck. Yeah. No.
Yeah. Swallow a bunch of pills. Glug, 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 glug. I'm going to have nice dreams and never wake up. No, I hope burns in hell.
Yeah. Same.
So Justin, her husband, was called to testify as well about that he had called into Crime Stoppers and what he'd called into Crime Stoppers.
Justin's brother?
What?
What did you say?
Justin, her husband.
Oh, Justin, her husband.
Was called to testify that he called into Crime Stoppers and what he had said to Crime Stoppers. Did I? I don't know. Maybe I did. I'm not sure.
I don't know. It probably
We weren't talking about Justin's brother. If he has a brother, I'm not sure. But Justin's brother, I'm pretty sure, didn't play like any part in the trial if he exists. Just okay. Justin.
Just Justin.
And whose real name is actually, what happened Stanley. To my voice? Yeah, his real name's actually Stanley. So he's on trial saying that she told him that she did return to the house to make sure everyone was dead. And that's when she found Rachel choking on her own blood, trying to call the police, and that she beat her to death with a gun until she was dead.
Fucking bitch.
Yep. So here's the thing. We don't really know if she, I'm assuming that the ones to the groin were made by her, but we don't have like proof of that. But we know that she's the one who like finished Rachel off.
Mm-hmm.
That she, you know, ended it for her.
Made sure she was dead.
Yeah. That felt really bad to say finish her off.
Yeah, it sounded really bad.
But I mean, like, she was like, nope, you're not living. Like, I'm killing you.
She made sure that she did not.
That she couldn't call the police.
Yeah, that she didn't survive.
Yeah.
She didn't survive the attack.
So bullets from two separate guns were recovered at the scene. Kim Downs, who's the state's firearms examiner at the time, maybe still today, I'm not sure, testified that the bullets were from both sets of guns that were found in the bodies of Tiffany and Marcus, that they were both shot by the two different guns.
Mm-hmm.
The bullets were later traced to two handguns that were in Louisville, Kentucky, that were stored at Christopher's stepfather's home.
Okay. So the guns belonged to Christopher.
Yep.
Okay.
But they were in storage, so they were, you know, at least traceable. But yeah, like there's definitely admittance of guilt. You killed yourself. Your family has the guns. Yeah, you did it.
Yeah.
You're just a cowardly piece of shit.
1 + 1 = 2.
1 + 1 = 3 in this case. She's also involved.
Well, I'm not. I wasn't counting people. I was counting guns and suicide.
So Dr. Morna Gonsulin, the state's medical examiner, testified that in addition to having several gunshot wounds, Rachel suffered skull fractures consistent with blunt force trauma to the head. And I believe she's the only one who had blunt force trauma, that she wasn't just shot up a bunch of times, that she, you know, that it was a brutal attack specifically done to Rachel. Mm-hmm. Part of the defense strategy was to attack Justin's credibility because they said that he called into Crime Stoppers to claim that the reward was being, that he was like trying to get the reward, collect the reward that was being offered. Mm-hmm. Then they argued that he made a deal with the state to falsely testify against his wife to avoid his pending drug charges, because obviously they found them in the hotel room with 70 vials of heroin. Yeah. And they were clearly using, there was other drugs there, I think, too, because they said that they were also using cocaine. Mm-hmm. But I didn't see anything about them finding cocaine, just the 70 vials of heroin. Anyway, that's, yeah, his ass should be in jail for that. And then he allegedly also had a deal with Thomas Pardue, who, okay, I was trying to find exactly who he is. I can't. I'm assuming maybe he's part of like the DA for drugs, drug related, that made some kind of a deal with him to stand trial and he won't go to jail for drug usage. Mm-hmm. Cut him some kind of a deal.
Yeah.
Anyway, trying to, you know, that this deal had allegedly with Thomas, and then Justin and Thomas's daughter Lane began dating like right after Christine was arrested. So it's just like all kind of messy. Yeah. I don't know why he would let his daughter date him, but I guess to each their own. Maybe he wasn't a horrible bad person. He was just in a horrible bad stage in life, because to be fair, he did get up there and testify against her. So
yeah,
I guess he's not all bad, right?
Correct. Yeah, because don't you have the right to not testify against your spouse?
Yeah, spousal privilege, I think.
Yeah. And he's like, no, she said she did it.
Yeah, I'm good with that. So I was trying to, again, find out exactly who he is, but I can't find exactly who he is. But the closing argument that referred to Justin's alleged deal with him and his relationship with the Pardue family, the prosecutor told jury, quote, "Mr. Pardue, I feel sorry for that man. I truly do. I mean, he has gone through hell for his daughter, but you don't get to know everything. You probably figured out by now that you could not know all the facts and circumstances of a case. Here's making objections. You've got to go outside the room. You come back inside. You don't know the whole truth about everything that's happened in this case. When it's all over, we will tell you the whole truth."
Okay.
So I think they're just trying to like pin some of it, like that Justin's a bad person and against him. I don't know. It doesn't really have a lot of prevalence to Christine's actual murder trial.
No.
But it's just kind of an interesting point of the case that, yeah, you know, they're trying to target Justin, even though I like Justin personally, testified against her.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't, I don't know. Addiction's bad. Addiction's a demon. It's a whole thing. But also, by the same token, it doesn't sound like he was a horrible, terrible, bad human, because, again, he testified against her.
Well, yeah. I mean, like you said, it's a demon. It's a thing. But it doesn't necessarily make you a bad person.
Yeah, exactly.
It just means you're making bad choices.
Yeah, bad choice doesn't make a bad person.
Correct.
A set of repeated bad choices, sure, for a lifetime, yes, can, yes, make you a bad
killing
person.
Killing people, as an example.
Yes, Christine, as an example. Mm-hmm. On October 13th.
I don't like that closing argument, because it just feels like a bunch of bullshit statements. You don't know the whole truth and we'll tell you at the end. Like, right. What the fuck?
Like I said, I think they were just trying to paint the husband in a bad light, mm-hmm, even though it's like, why?
Yeah. And if the whole truth is going to get her off, then don't you want to say that in fucking court?
Literally. Yeah. It's like, and he said it. He was like, yeah, she told me all these things. Mm-hmm. She said that, actually, I don't know if she said that she beat her over the head, but we knew that it was a passion, therefore it wasn't Christopher. Mm-hmm. And she admitted to going back in the house to making sure that they were all dead. So it happened later.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the going back into the house was like 5 minutes later or 2 hours later, but we know that it happened at about 3:30. Their bodies were found at about 6:30.
Okay.
So anyway, on October 13th, 2008, the jury convicted Christine of 4 counts of capital murder, as she was 17 at the time of the crime. She wasn't able to have the death penalty, which she would have gotten because they're in Texas.
Yeah.
So
I'm glad.
The following day, she was sentenced to life in prison. I know, me too. I literally was having this conversation with a friend yesterday, and I was like, the death penalty, yeah, it sucks, and it's like this huge super debate about ethics and whatever, but I'm not here to debate the ethics of it. It just feels like the easy way out to get the death penalty. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sucks, obviously, for those people who were wrongly convicted. That fucking sucks.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
It's undoable.
Yeah, but, you know, life in prison and you're guilty. You have to sit there and think about what you did every day and what put you here. And hopefully, you know, you rot a little bit for it.
Yeah.
And you repent a little bit for it. I mean, I don't care if she's repenting. I don't care if anyone's repenting or not for what they did. Just that they have to sit there and think about it and that they don't get to die. Sorry, yeah. I smacked the microphone. Exactly. That they don't get to die. So on November 29, 2008, on the grounds that, quote, the trial court abused its discretion in setting Christine's amount of bail at $500,000, she tried to file an appeal, but they decided that it wasn't an abuse of discretion and affirmed her original sentence. Then in 2009, she and Justin divorced. Then in 2011, she filed more appeals, which were also denied. And as of this month in 2025, she's incarcerated at the Christina Melton Crane Unit in Gatesville, Texas, and she'll be eligible for parole in July of 2046 when she'll be 60 years old.
That's not fair.
Now, I want to wrap it up with a pretty bow because fuck that bitch. And let's talk about the victims.
Mm-hmm.
So first, there's Adalbert Sanchez, who we know as D. He was referred to as D. His obit didn't have much information, unfortunately. Of course, you know, there's not a ton of information to be found about everyone.
I hate it.
But he was the one who just moved into the area. He was Marcus's cousin. He was, you know, trying to turn his life around for the better. But his legacy page is full of messages from people who loved him. And I did enjoy reading that.
Aw.
But it hadn't been updated since 2003.
Well, yeah, but still, I mean, that's when he died. And so people are like, well, I love you, I miss you.
Yeah.
They're not going to 15 years later go on there, you know.
Unless they do.
But you said they didn't.
Not on his. So the inscription on Marcus's headstone says, his laugh still echoes, his life still inspires, his light still shines, and always will.
I got goosebumps.
I know. I'm sorry. We're actually probably going to cry.
I don't cry.
Marcus Ray Priscilla, 19, was born August 29th, 1983, and was taken from us Friday, July 18th, 2003. His loving and giving spirit left the world to be present with the Lord. Marky, beloved son, brother, and grandson, nephew, cousin, and friend, is preceded in death by his eternal popo, Jimmy Longora. And then, you know, just about his family right here, about who's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
He was a compassionate, generous, loving, gentle young man who took much joy in his car restoration hobby. His proudest accomplishments were graduating from high school, pursuing his goals at San Jacinto College, and being the best son a mother could ever have. Marcus, rest in peace with the love of his life, Tiffany. And then information about...
You're right, I might cry.
I told you, it gets even worse.
Cool.
Again, there's not a lot about Tiffany out there either, unfortunately. She doesn't have a very significant obit, except for the fact like who she survived by and the information about her service. But it's pretty cool that instead of asking for flowers, the family was like, please make donations to either Crime Stoppers or the Los Ninos International Adoption Agency. On her legacy page, there are a lot of sweet messages. Rachel's dad wrote to her, sweet Tiffany, you were just a little girl like my Rachel. How tragic. The world is a lesser place without your beautiful smile. My head hurts for your family and the families of Marcus and Adalbert. I'm sorry, I have such a hard time saying his name. You are all in my heart and prayers. And then there's Miss Rachel. This is from her Find a Grave and her obit. I'm sorry, I can't words. I'm having such a hard time and I'm tearing up.
I know, me too.
I'm Rachel up. Was born on November 20th, 1984 to George and Anne Colorotis. Rachel recently graduated from Clear Lake High School and had plans to attend college. She loved her country and considered joining the United States Air Force. Rachel was a diligent worker and received exemplary reviews by each of her employers. She was employed by the UPS store and Randall's and Denny's over the last few years. Rachel frequently babysat neighborhood children because she loved and adored them. She was a talented artist. Her drawings are cherished by her family. She loved to cook and was always eager to perform household chores. Rachel led a co-ed youth drama ministry at the Clear Creek Community Church from 1999 to 2001. She also served as a youth counselor at various summer camps and vacation Bible schools. She loved life and was known for her long, beautiful, flowing hair and sensational smile. She had a quick wit and was fun to be around. She loved her brother and two sisters deeply. She was the apple of her mother's eye and her daddy's little girl. We love you, Rachel. You're beautiful. We'll miss you all the days of our lives. And then, of course, you know, the info about who she survived by and where she's buried.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to leave with some of the messages from her dad that are on her legacy page. This is the one from July 16th of 2020. Rachel, I think about you every day. I love and miss you so much. I want to write to say something profound and meaningful to you. But as usual, I can't come up with anything. I'm sorry, honey. So sorry. In 2 days, the anniversary of your death comes to us again. Your sisters are doing well and are busy having children, each with good husbands. Not sure how heaven works, but I hope you know these things. Of course, your mommy and daddy miss you every single day, every day. And then on July 16th of this year, I know my mom's crying. She never cries. I'm crying too. I miss you every day. I will always wait until I see you in heaven. I love my dear daughter. He wrote that to her this year. That's what I'm so saying. Sad. Like, he still writes on her legacy page.
Yeah, because you said unless they do.
Right. Yeah. And people were writing also, like, more recently on Tiffany's legacy page. Like I said, like, her dad, George, who's writing all these things. Who
Rachel's dad.
Yes, Rachel's dad, George. Yeah. Yeah, I just couldn't, you know. Obviously, we got a lot about Rachel because her family wanted to make sure it was out there and that her name was known and all these things. But I don't have a lot of that for the other victims, unfortunately. Yeah. Like, there's not a lot that I could find about them.
So sad.
Yeah. It's fucking horrible. And, yep, of course, you know, the information that's out there is about the murderer.
Always.
Not all the victims.
Yeah. And that's when we started the podcast. That was part of what we wanted to do, was really to
shine the light
on the victims and make them the story and not the murderer. But unfortunately, as we've progressed, we realized that
there's a reason why it goes the way it goes.
Yeah.
I mean, regardless of whether people are victim focused or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people that are, you know, doing the things that we do.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that just is so fucking sad. I'm a mommy. I would die.
Yeah, it's fucking devastating. I know, I can't imagine. Like, it's just horrible. Absolutely horrible. I mean, these were people that had their whole lives ahead of them, and then they were robbed by a jealous girl that literally gave them, that they gave her everything. They saw her light, and then she stole theirs.
Dirty piece of shit, to quote Daphne.
Yeah, she is a dirty piece of shit.
Well, thank you.
They both are.
Yeah.
Her and Christopher.
For sure.
That's why I was like, when I was trying to learn how to say some of these names, I was like, I don't care about her last name.
I didn't even worry too much about that.
I didn't even look. I was like, yeah, her name's Christine. We don't usually refer to them as their last names anyway. So
yeah,
didn't really much matter to me.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's it.
Well, thank you. You did do a great job. I think you did it justice. I've never heard of it. So I think you presented it very well.
Thank you. I hope so, too. I hope, you know, if any of the families tune in that, you know, they're okay with the way I presented it. It just broke my heart. And that's why I couldn't rabbit hole too hard, because I was like, I don't want to know about the friends that found their bodies. I don't want to know about their devastation.
Yeah.
It's going to break my heart even further. And it's great that they found their bodies, but they're not the story. Correct. The story is this ugly piece of shit and the four beautiful lives that were stolen.
Exactly.
The two ugly pieces of shit.
Two ugly pieces of shit.
All right. Well, you can follow us on Instagram at That's Disturbing Podcast, where you can send us a case request. I'd love to get a case request. I'm working on Vienna's. It's just, I needed, like we just said, to do something true crimey. So Vienna's is in the works and will be my next priority. All right. Well, that's all I've got. Bye-bye.